So quite a lot has already been said about loop quantum gravity bouncers, and we are all tired, so I will make it brief, trying to focus on what has not yet been discussed and putting an emphasis on reliability, open issues, and links with observations. So I want to begin with a remark about covariance, about the point raised by Neil the other day. I think that's a very interesting point to wonder if we can find a covariant description of the modified Friedmann equation, whereas no new degree of freedom is a priori introduced in the theory. So it might seem that the answer is no, because we all know that if we require second-order equations and covariance, we are uniquely led to Einstein equations, Einstein-Lagrangian with a cosmological constant, and therefore to the Friedmann equation under the appropriate symmetry assumption. But it is not that simple, because actually, when people think in this way, in formulation involving higher-order derivatives of the metric, one implicitly usually assumes the compatibility of the metric spacetime that is a vanishing divergence. But the point is that in this framework, we are working with the Hasteka-Barbero connection, which is something else. And it is known in the quantum setting that there is no operator associated with it. And therefore, it might be more meaningful to look for metric affine theories and to think in this context. And in this context, if you assume a connection which is basically torsionless and uncoupled to matter, you end up with so-called Palatini gravity, where the action is of this form. And if you restrict yourself to f of r actions, then this the auxiliary metric which is introduced is actually conformal to the usual metric with a conformal factor which is a trace of the stress energy tensor. And the very important point is that in this framework, the field equation has the same number of degrees of freedom as in JR. So basically, you have the same phase space as in JR, but still the dynamics is different because you change the way matter generates curvature. So in this framework, it is possible to have indeed a new dynamics, whereas you don't introduce any new degree of freedom. And actually, the inverse problem has been solved. What I call the inverse problem is to find a Palatini covariant action which leads to the modified Friedmann equation, and it was shown by those people that it seems to work. So that was just a remark. In the rest of my talk, I'm going to focus on the background. So I just say a few words about perturbations. So there is this nice dressed metric approach developed by Hasteka, Agulho, Nelson, and other people. I think it's very interesting because it really tries to deal with quantum fields on a quantum background, so to really extract as much as possible from the full quantum theory. And I was lucky because I haven't seen the slide from Ivan, so I chose the only plot, well, one of the only plots he has not shown, so luckily. So this is what happens if you do what he describes, that is to use the freedom we have, including the vacuum for the excited modes that are different vacua that are related by Bogoliubov transformations, and it shows the enhancement case, and this is a case where the power decreases on small scales. There are other approaches, but in particular hybrid quantization, that are very interesting, but I don't have time to describe them now. Of course, as for any work in progress, there are also consistency issues here, and I would like to say a few words about another approach that Martin has also briefly described, because he was one of the first people to suggest this way of seeing, which is to put the emphasis on the consistency of the theory. What I mean here is really to take into account the specifics of gravity in the sense that gravity, in a way, is pure gauge. So you really don't want to gauge it before quantizing, because the problem is that if you do that, you might fix the gauge according to constraints that will subsequently receive quantum corrections, and therefore the theory might be inconsistent. So what we do here is probably less related with the Mother theory. So to me, the link with loop quantum gravity is rather weak, but it is a generalized approach, which at least is consistent in the semi-classical sense. So we implement holonomic corrections in the Hamiltonian. There is some freedom here, because there are integers that are not fixed by the theory. We calculate the tensor, vector, and scalar perturbation up to the desired order. We add counter terms, and there is also some freedom here, with a requirement, of course, that they do vanish at the classical limit. And we end up with a first-class Dirac algebra, which means that the vectors of evolution are parallel to the manifold of constraints, and therefore it's clear, the meaning of the theory is completely clear. So the good news is that there is a solution. The very good news is that it is nearly unique. This is not a theorem. This is just a consequence of the specific shape of the function that we use. So it's under some hypothesis. And this solution works for all kinds of perturbations. I mean, you could say this is the least we can ask, but taking into account the mathematical structure, it was not obvious from the beginning. And it also agrees with other approaches, in particular developed by Edouard, that I also don't have to mention here. This is somehow a kind of dynamical realization of the BKL conjecture, in the sense that as this asymptotic silent surface, all the space points decouple one from the other. And it means that when you go to the Planck density, the space-time structure becomes effectively Euclidean. So everything is encoded in this algebra, where my omega function here is what Martin called beta yesterday, so one day or the other we should agree on the Greek letter we use. This omega is plus one in the classical limit, I mean for low density. It is minus one at the Planck density, at the bound density, and it is vanishing at half the Planck density. So you have a kind of soft Vic rotation when going to the bounds. Okay, so what to do with that? So we have tried to compute the associated power spectrum, which is basically incompatible with data. So I want to be clear here. There are very crude assumptions. We assume that there is no back reaction, which is wrong. We assume that there is no anisotropy, which is wrong. We assume that there is no transplanckian effect, which is wrong. So obviously, we do not disqualify LQC. That's completely obvious. But to me, that's good news that some settings of the theory. but I mean, you know, people outside quantum gravity usually say that quantum gravity is metaphysics. And here we prove that it can be falsified. We have a setting that has a correct infrared limit, which predicts inflation, and which is still incompatible with data. And that's not such bad news for the vitality of the field. So let me just tell you why in one word. In one word, there is a UV growth now of the spectrum, which is completely driven by this instability associated with the change of signature. And the point is that you cannot even do a fine-tuning of the amount of inflation so that the observable window falls in the infrared, because if you do that, you have a huge amount of deflation before the bounds, and the spectrum is increased anyway. So this is really a no-go theorem in this particular setting. So recently, we have calculated also the scalar power spectrum. So you see this z prime prime over z function that enters the equation of motion is rather complicated now. This is the shape of this function as a function of the scale factor of the universe. And this is the resulting spectrum with the same ultraviolet divergence.
Can I just ask a quick clarification question on it?
Sorry.
About the previous transparency, you sort of said something about the Euclidean regime.
Yeah.
And now we are talking about a bounce. So
this is but okay, here there is a controversy. So to me, this is not incompatible because I view the Euclidean regime as an effective effect for the perturbation. I mean, we don't know for the background, because you know at the background level, the Poisson bracket is vanishing. So my view is that time fundamentally still exists, but this is the effective space-time structure seen by perturbation. This is a hypothesis.
I see. Okay. So you're saying that there's a bounce, but...
So now I want to make a point, which is, which was also raised during the talk of Ivan. I have a problem with the fact that we are using a theory which basically tells us that there is nothing smaller than the Planck scale. This is not completely true, because the length operator is more subtle than the area operator. But still, we are dealing with modes that are completely transplanckian at the bounds time, unless we tune the duration of inflation for that. So, you know, in the black hole sector, Carlo, Francesca, and others have recently claimed that we have focused too much on length effect. We should take into account density effect. And I think that in cosmology, this is just the opposite. People have worked a lot about the bounds dynamics, so focusing on density effect, but we have somehow forgotten length effect. So I think we cannot really do nothing about this part of the spectrum and say it just agrees. In this case, it disagrees with observation. In the case of Ivan, it agrees with observation. But actually, there is a problem, because this part of the spectrum is completely transplanckian for generic values of the inflation, and therefore something has to be done. So what should be done is what Ivan and Abai have started to do, building on the Ashtekar-Lewandowski theorem of quantum fields on a quantum background, but I cannot do that in this deformed algebra approach. So a kind of poor man's game that we can play to deal with Franck and Mauss is maybe to incorporate modified dispersion relations as initiated by Robert and the other people 10 years ago. And the first results are quite interesting because we violate some WKB conditions and therefore something new can happen. But the point here is that something has to be done. I don't know what. So now let me go back to the background. My personal confidence level on the existence of a bounce in LQC is very high. I think that's now a quite robust prediction. It has been shown for exactly solvable models. It has been shown in presence of either positive or negative curvature for anisotropic models with a negative and a positive cosmological constant, for a massive scalar field, for very wide classes of states. So okay, we can always ask more, but I think we have now a very interesting bunch of evidence in favor of the bounce. I don't need to write again this well-known, now modified Feynman equation. I just mentioned what Edward has explained in details. In the case of group field theory, where the cosmological dynamics is understood as a kind of hydrodynamical limit of a condensed state in the Gross-Petayevsky approximation, we end up basically with the same equation with a slight shift in energy, which I think is a very good point. But I want to spend some time now on something that has not yet been discussed at this conference, that are the result obtained in quantum reduced loop gravity. That can probably be understood as an intermediate state between the full theory and the classical LQC view. So basically, quantum reduced loop gravity is trying to perform quantization before symmetry reduction, which is good, but the price to pay for that is a gauge fixing. And it is based on implementing in the Hilbert space of LQG the gauge conditions that allows to diagonalize the tensor and triod just to make the calculations tractable. And this leads to a reduced Hilbert space whose elements are based on cuboidal graphs and are described at length by U1 group elements projected on the SU2 ones. So if you want, you build the Hamiltonian from the expectation value of the quantum Hamiltonian constraints, and you take into account that you have several microstates corresponding to the same macrostates, and you average over them with the appropriate weight, and you take the Gaussian limit of the bimodal function. And at the end of the day, you have those variables that have a non-vanishing Poisson bracket. This is the resulting Hamiltonian. There are issues with this Hamiltonian. I'm going to mention them in a minute, but I want to begin with the result. The result is that from this Hamiltonian, you derive this modified Feynman equation, which can be understood as the kind of generalization of the previous one with this new term that the author called gravitational energy density, but actually it's not gravitational energy density. But
question, should that be a small V rho g? Is it the same as the volume of the original?
Yeah, you're right. It should be a small V. Yeah, V0 should not happen.
So it actually changes if you change this V0.
That's the point I'm going to make in 10 seconds. So the result is this one. We are here, you go backward in time, and you have the bounce. But before the bounce, instead of having a contracting branch, you have a kind of emerging branch. So that's quite interesting because we usually have two classes of models, the bouncing models like in LQC or many other approaches, and you have the emergent universe like in string gas cosmology or some kind of Galilean cosmology. And here there is a kind of mixture. There is this long static phase, a little bounce, and then the universe we see today. So that's quite interesting, but it raises conceptual issues that are quite interesting in my opinion. And the main issue here is that, as Martin is suggesting, in this Hamiltonian, some terms are intensive and some terms are extensive. So this is problematic because it means, you know, it's a kind of soccer balloon problem. It means that you take the universe, it has a volume. You can take the Hubble volume of the universe. You go backward in time and you say at some point the volume is such that it will receive quantum corrections and eventually it will bounce. But if you take a smaller part of the universe, which is still classical and isotropic, it is smaller and therefore it will receive quantum corrections at a different time, and you end up with the conclusion that it does not bounce at the same time as the full universe, which obviously has no meaning. The second point is the one I think Robert mentioned a few days ago, and that I also mentioned to the author of this paper, that even taking the Hubble volume is not completely consistent because the comobile Hubble volume is time dependent, so it doesn't really make sense. So here you break a fundamental symmetry of cosmology, which is a rescaling of the scale factor. And when you have a wave in the universe, you can understand that. You have a wave and you go backward in time, and at some point it becomes Planckian, and something can happen. But here we are completely homogeneous and isotropic. So it's really hard to understand how a physical scale can enter the game here. So from the classical viewpoint, I think it just doesn't work. But now from the quantum viewpoint, it's not completely stupid, because as Edward explained, you see space-time as a kind of network of cells. Either the cells are growing or the number of cells is increasing, which is probably a better view. But then it might be that the quantum system is not invariant by varying the number of cells. For example, if you take a Bose-Einstein condensate, the dynamics does depend on the number of particles. So I think here we should not just say this Hamiltonian is crazy and let's consider something else. We have to understand the transition between the scale free and the scaleful versions of the theory. So I would like this problem to disappear at the classical limit. This is not the case at this time, but this is something I think we really have to understand. Okay, now just a detail about the background. That's not very important, but I want to make the point. Ivan said that he has basically just one free parameter, which is the value of the field at the bounds. So my point now is, it's very good that we didn't speak together, because actually it's perfectly complementary. I would like to argue that actually this free parameter is not even free, and that it is mostly fixed by the history of the universe, which might be good for the predictivity of the model. So I will explain in a minute why I think this parameter is fixed, but now let's not go into the details of why it is fixed, and let's just try to see how the number of defaults of inflation varies, depends on the subtle way LQC modifies the Friedmann equation. So I take the LQC Friedmann equation, and I take a toy model where I just glue a contracting Friedmann equation to an expanding Friedmann equation, which is completely forbidden by JR, of course, and I compare the prediction. And you see that the number of defaults is basically the same. There is a shift by a number of 10 here, and these are the trajectories in a fraction of potential energy square root versus number of defaults for different initial conditions. And you see that basically the trajectories are the same. So my point here is just to say that all that I'm going to say now is actually related to the fact that we have a bounce and that LQC fixes the energy scale of the bounce. But the subtle way in which we arrive at the bounce and we escape from the bounce is basically irrelevant. You can even compute the spectra that are meaningless, but just to compare, and once again, they are nearly the same. What I call JR here is not at all JR, okay? It is a pseudo-bounce by gluing JR solutions, okay? So, now the point. So, I think we have basically three unknown things in this model. The amount of shear, and once again, the point raised by Robert is very important, because the anisotropies scale as 1 over a to the 6. So the very reason why they decrease very fast in an expanding universe is the reason why they increase very fast in a contracting universe. So unless you are ekpyrotic, where by construction this problem is evaded, you have to take anisotropies into account. You just cannot ignore anisotropies. This would be inconsistent. So we have, but fortunately LQC has been developed in an anisotropic context. So the amount of shear is something we don't know. The second thing we don't know is the shape of the inflaton. We don't even know if there is a scalar field. So I assume a scalar field. This is an assumption. But this scalar field, I have to assume a potential. And the third point is initial conditions. So what we've done recently is to vary those three unknown points and to try to understand whether the predictions are robust or not. So this is just a point about initial conditions. So this circle here, so this is the square root of the fraction of potential and kinetic energy. The circle corresponds to the maximum energy density, so this is the bounds. And the point here, corresponds to a vanishing energy density, so remote past and remote future. Okay? So the universe begins here, ends here, and this is the bounds. If you want to have trajectories that are equally spaced, like that, for your probability distribution function, then you need trajectories in the remote past to be extremely fine-tuned and selected to have this. This is a zoom on this part of this. And you see that the trajectories are not at all random. If you take random trajectories in the past, what happens at the bounds is this. You select a very specific point at the bounds. That's good news. It means that the amount of potential energy, or kinetic energy, of course, are related at the bounds, is not a free parameter. It is selected by the dynamics of the universe.
What is shear?
Shear is not yet here. Sorry. At this point, it's not here. It will arrive in the next slide. Here, there is no shear. So this is just to show you that everything is possible in LQC. This is big deflation, no inflation. No deflation, big inflation. A little deflation, a little inflation. Everything is possible, but everything is not equally probable. That's my point. So now let me come to the generalized Friedmann equation. So this is the modified Friedmann equation by taking into account both the holonomic correction from LQC and the shear. So sigma Q is quantum shear. So this is the basic equation we are using. And these are the four potentials we have considered. So this is massive scalar field, which is not very favored by data, but which is extremely convenient to compare models. This is a linear potential. This is a string theory inspired potential, just to see that we are open-minded. It looks like this. And this is a Starobinsky potential, just because data like it very much. So these are the four potentials that I have studied. And these are the results. So here, we put initial conditions in the past. So let me explain what it means. Because, of course, what does it mean? It means that I assume a flat probability distribution function for the phase of the field. I will argue later why I think this is meaningful. But the point is not to put them in the past or at the bounds. The point is to which variable I assign a given PDF. So here I take a flat PDF for the phase of the field because you have an oscillator, you make a picture of the oscillator and you say, okay, this is just something which is completely random. And if I do that, I have this result for the PDF of the number of epochs of inflation. This is something picked at 140. I mean, that's nice because in JR, it can be anything between 0 and 10 to the 13 if you fix the energy max energy density at the Planck density. So here, this is picked, and this is n as a function of delta, and you see that unless you fine-tune delta, it is always between 120 and 160. And here, when going to this line and to this line, you just increase the amount of shear. So you see that here it is peaked at 140, now it is peaked at a lower value, and if you really put a lot of shear, the distribution becomes bimodal because the bounds can be either energy or shear dominated. Okay? And this is for the linear potential, so it looks like the same. It's peaked at 190, it's not very different, and also it decreases when you increase the shear. You might wonder why it's not Gaussian anymore. The answer is that it has no reason to be Gaussian. So don't wonder anymore. The shape is strange, but we have checked that this is not a numerical instability. This is for
real. So the 60 on this last left-hand plot is coming from density-dominated bounds. You said that is a bimodal error. So which one is which one? So
yeah, this one is shear dominated, right. And this one isn't. Okay. Yeah.
We have both of inflation, zero or totally both.
This is a total number of volts of inflation between just inflation. We don't include between the bounds and inflation and after inflation. So this is for the string-like potential. So it's again peaked around 150. Of course, it's bimodal because the potential is asymmetric. So you have two ways to climb the potential. And this is for the Starobinsky potential. And this is the only case where it's completely different. So forget about the dashed line. This is a detailed. So forget about that. Concentrate on the full line. And here it's peaked at 10 to the 8. It's completely different. Why? Because the potential is extremely flat. So if you arrive with a lot of energy, we go very, very, very far on the potential. So this is the main conclusion that I will come to later. Now we do the same, but setting initial conditions at the bounds. So once again, what is important is not to set them at the bounds. What is implicit here is that we now take a flat PDF for XB, for the fraction of potential energy at the bounds. And we assign this PDF to X and we look at the result. And you see that it's completely different. It's the same model, but now the PDF, so forget about the dashed line, the correct one is the full line. And the PDF now is peaked at 10 to the 12. It was 100 before. It's completely different. Just because here, of course, if you take a flat PDF for X, the generic behavior is that you have a lot of inflation. And this is well known. This is from the first Linde articles, it was known. And you have basically the same result for all potentials. So we are hungry, so I don't show you everything. So my conclusions about initial conditions, because that was one of the questions. So if the word initial is taken literally, I think it makes sense to put initial conditions at the beginning, so before the bounds. But mathematically, this is not a very strong argument. So let me argue for this view. First, I think it is physically quite obvious. I mean, you have a random process, and you know what you don't know. And what you don't know is the phase of the oscillator. That's just, I think, a fact. In addition, the vicinity of the balance is probably the most quantum period in the history of the universe. So this is not where I would like to put initial conditions. A flat PDF for the fraction of potential energy, I think, is completely arbitrary. You can think in terms of the fraction of potential energy and not in terms of the phase. This is completely okay. But why would you assign a flat PDF to this variable? You can take an exponential PDF. It's exactly as meaningful. So I think that this is not very predictive. And the important point is that the flat PDF for the phase is preserved over time. This is an important point. So what is the predictive power of the theory? I think we should distinguish between two different predictive power. Weak predictive power, as I define it, means you know the PDF for the number of e-folds. Strong predictive power means you know the number of e-folds, which means you know the PDF and the PDF is picked. So the result is that if we put initial conditions in the past, I'm going to go fast, if the potential is confining, not plateau-like, then I think we have a strong predictive power of the theory. If either you decide to put initial conditions at the bounds for some reason, or the potential is plateau-like, then you have either weak or even no predictive power at all. So this is my result. But there is a conceptual point I want to raise because we were asked to put emphasis on open problems that are not goodness, but just open questions. And to me, the open question is about the shear. I know how to compute the evolution if I assume a given amount of shear, but I don't know how to put a reliable PDF on the shear. I mean, I am quite confident that putting a flat PDF on the phase of the scalar field makes sense, but I don't have anything equivalent for the shear. I mean, that's for me a very important point to address, because if I change the shear, I change the number of e-folds, for sure. But what is the most favored value of shear at the bounds? I have absolutely no idea on how to answer this question, because it is not time independent. If I take another hypersurface, I will have another, whatever the PDF I choose, it will not be preserved over time. So this, I don't know how to solve that. This might be an argument in favor of putting the initial condition at the bounds, because here we have a selected time. But I think this is even worse, because here you can show that you have infinitely many more solutions that have no classical limits. So I don't have time to describe this, but I think this is not an answer. So this is not a weakness of LQC. This is just a point we have to address in any, I think, bouncing model. In most, not all, but most bouncing models.
Let's ask you a quick remark about the probability, that probability distribution is preserving time. So what dynamics are you using?
The dynamics predicted by the Friedman equation. Modified, of course. But I mean, we don't really care they are modified because we put the initial conditions far away from the bounds, not too far, otherwise it's not anymore scalar field dominated.
So the statement is that they're preserved in the sense that the classical relativity error, it doesn't matter where you...
Exactly, that's the point.
Another question is that when you consider this flat probability distributions of phi in the past, sometimes I wonder if the fact that phi has to be coupled to standard model, has to be unstable, because otherwise there is no reheating. Yeah. So why should I give the same probability to large values of phi than the small values of phi and large velocity? I think the fact that this...
At the bounds?
No, far into the past.
But, I mean, if you have...
The phi is unstable...
Why would the fact that it's coupled to matter would change that? I mean...
Because it's a good decay, very fast.
Sure, but then it oscillates, right?
Right, but
it oscillates, and you take a picture of the pendulum here, and you wonder where is it? It's anywhere. I don't care. I mean, because there is no correlation between the bounce time and the time at which it is formed.
But the evolution of that initial data from far into the past to the bounce.
I agree. You mean it's deterministic. I agree with that. But I think when you assign a flat PDF, you don't mean it is not deterministic. It means that you don't know how to... to me, it's like you say you have a planet orbiting a star, and you wonder where it is. Well, sure, it's deterministic. But when you take a picture, you have no way to predict where it's going to be. That's just contingent.
I agree with that. But it's more a question than anything else.
So
in the evolution, one should take into account the fact how, you know, the evolution of this initial probability distribution to a PDF at the bounds, yeah, one should take into account, question mark, the fact that phi is unstable, that it could decay really rapidly to the standard model, so.
But, I mean, it will decay when, you mean at rating? When should it decay before the bounds? It will decay after the bounds, after inflation.
Yeah. Imagine that the decay rate is of the
but,
order
but
of...
But if it decays, then we don't have a scalar field anymore. We have a...
It's a scalar field, but it's in the bottom of the potential. So as soon as it goes up, it will decay and go to the bottom.
Okay, we can discuss that. That could be...
So it's more a question than anything.
No, but that could be a good point. Let's discuss that later. So I will finish fast, don't worry, with black holes. Because nothing has been said today about bounces in black holes. So basically the idea is that what happens in cosmology should also happen for black holes. So this is an old idea, but it has been recently revived in a new way by Carlo, Francesca and Hall. And in a very qualitative way, the idea is that actually a black hole is not really a black hole, and the event horizon is a trapping horizon, and matter collapses, it reaches a Planck density, and then it bounces. And the nice point demonstrated by Rovelli and Hagar is that actually it's possible to find in the double cover of the Kruskal solution a metric which is insensitive to this effect at large scale, but which behaves correctly at low scale. So this is the Penrose diagram. So one is what? One is Minkowski, two is Schwarzschild, and three is a quantum region. And the interesting point is that the bouncing time is expected to be of the order of m squared, but you know that the Hawking time is of the order of m cubed, so it means that the black hole is going to bounce faster than it evaporates. So in this model, the idea is that the Hawking evaporation is a kind of dissipative correction to the bounce, which becomes the main phenomenon.
That's so, a hole, right?
Sorry?
That's a hole, that it goes like m squared.
So, second part, now a full quantum LQG calculation has been done by those people. So this is just to impress you, not you, because you will not be impressed, but to impress people outside of the community and to show that a big calculation has been done. So it's correct that at this stage, the complete formula has not been derived, but the claim is that this supports the idea that tau is proportional to m squared. But the prefactor is completely free at this stage. So this is how I understand the situation. So I use my last 5-10 minutes to go to the phenomenology of this phenomenon. So let's assume it's correct and let's see what it gives. So I begin by taking the lower allowed value for this k factor, which is of the order of 0.05. So if I want to see the bounce, I just have to fix the bouncing time to be equal to the Hubble time. And you see that the mass in this case is 10 to the 23 kilograms, which as expected is higher than the mass of a black hole which takes the age of the universe to Hawking evaporate, that is 10 to the 12 grams. So this is expected. So size is a fraction of a millimeter and the energy available is huge. So there are two possible components for the decay of those black holes. A low energy channel, which is basically driven by dimensional analysis. You have only one scale of the problem, which is the size of the horizon, pseudo-horizon, and you expect the particles to be emitted with a wavelength which is of the order of the size, and this leads to something in the far infrared and the possible link with fast radio bursts. And there is a second channel that I call the high energy one, which is that in this model you basically form the black hole by the collapse of a null shell, and therefore what goes out should be what went in, because the amount of gravitational blue shift is exactly compensated by the same amount of gravitational red shift, and the black hole plays the role of a time freezing machine for the radiation of the early universe where it was formed, and basically what should go away is mimicking the thermal bath of the universe at the time of formation, and this leads to something in the TV range with a possible link with gamma ray burst. So now let me ask this question. Can we evaluate the maximum distance at which a single decaying or bouncing black hole can be seen? And we have studied that by varying the value of k, which is basically unknown, with a lower bound so that we have enough quantum effects for the processes to take care, and the upper bound, which is completely phenomenological, which is that you require the bouncing time to be smaller than the page time, or the Hawking time nearly doesn't change. So this is the result by varying this k value. So that's understandable that it basically decreases, because if you have a higher value of k, it means that the lifetime is higher, and therefore you have to pick up a smaller mass, and therefore the black holes are smaller, and therefore you have less energy, and in addition, each quantum is emitted at a higher energy. So you have two reasons for this behavior to decrease. And you take into account everything, the size of the detectors, the absorption of gamma rays or infrared light over cosmological distances, and you try to evaluate how to distinguish your signal from the background. I mean, you are all theorists here, but you know, if you have 10 gamma rays, it's easy to extract them from the background. If you have 10 infrared photons, it's completely impossible to distinguish them from the background. So it's not only the number which is important. It's the number divided by square root of the noise. Square root, because you're interested in fluctuations. And there are some funny features here that I don't have time to describe, but they are very elegant with those little steps here, for example, that are related to the fact that you open new channels at particles that will subsequently decay into gamma rays, etc., etc. And the result is that for some values of k, you can see the bouncing events everywhere in the universe. And for very high values of k, you are confined to within the Milky Way.
So why are there sudden peaks? What is...
The big one here, it's experimental, because this is the energy above which you have Cherenkov showers in the atmosphere, and therefore the effective size of the detector becomes much higher, and the sensitivity is therefore much, much better here.
This is supposed to be a theoretical plot, your
yes,
prediction, right?
Yes.
So why is there an earlier peak?
It's just because in the optical range we have larger telescopes, because the atmosphere is transparent, and here we are in the infrared or the UV, and we have to move satellites, and satellites are smaller than ground-based instruments. And this is for the high energy component, so you don't care about the details, but we took into account the electromagnetic decay of neutral pions and all these Messier hadrons that are produced by the high energy process. And the result at the end of the day is that it's quite far away. So for most of the parameter space, you could see a bouncing black hole quite far away in the universe. So that's quite good news for the model. And the point now we have to address...
What is far away?
You can look from the plot, okay? Far away, in the low energy channel, it means basically everywhere in the universe if you have a low value of k. This is the Hubble scale. So nearly everywhere in the universe, if a black hole bounces, you will see it. For the high energy channel, for a typical value of k, is of the order of the galactic scale. Now, an interesting point is that, you know, in astrophysics, when you have such kind of process, it might be interesting to look not at a single event detection, but at the integrated background produced by a distribution of bouncing black holes. So we have to integrate the individual flux to redshift it, the number density of exploding black holes per unit of time and volume, the acceptance of the detectors, the absorption probability. And we have shown, to me this is an important point, we have shown with Francesca that the resulting spectrum is merely independent of the mass spectrum of primordial black holes, because we don't know at all. First, we don't know if primordial black holes exist, and if they exist, we don't know the shape of the mass spectrum. So it's very important that our results do not depend on the shape of the mass spectrum. And at the end of the day, by redshift integrating everything, you end up with this kind of signals that can be for different values of this three parameter k. So that's not bad, because they are not completely diluted by the integration, and they still capture most of the shape of the signal before this integration. Last point, don't worry, less than 5 minutes. We wondered if we could explain the Fermi excess by this model. So you might know that the Fermi gamma ray satellite measures too many gamma rays coming from the center of the Milky Way with respect to astrophysical predictions. And we wondered if this could be due to bouncing black holes. So it cannot be explained by the high energy channel. It's anyway above the TeV, and this is in the GeV. It could be explained by the low energy channel by selecting a high value of k, explicitly the highest possible value of k. So we had to go through quite complicated fit of the Monte Carlo simulations of the decay of emitted particles. And at the end of the day, these are the results. So the red points are the data, and the blue curve is the model. So of course, there is no magic here. There are three parameters. So let's be honest. It feeds the data because we tune the free parameter so that it feeds the data. This is completely clear. But still, it was not obvious. Because I was afraid, before doing the calculation, that this secondary bump due to the secondary gamma rays coming from the decay of neutral pions would be higher than the signal and would be above the astrophysical background. So it came as a very good surprise to me that this bump is smaller than this one, and therefore we can explain the signal. So, I mean, I would not bet my life, okay, that the Fermi excess is due to bouncing black holes. We know that there are many other possible exotic explanations. But the interesting point to me is that we could, in principle, distinguish between these explanations and other explanations. Why? Because the funny point is the following. If this excess is due to astrophysics, which is the most probable explanation, or to decaying dark matter, then the redshift dependence is trivial. When you look at a galaxy which is Z, you will see the energy E divided by 1 plus Z. That's all. In our case, this is not trivial, because when you look at a galaxy which is far away, it means that you see black holes that have bounced in the past, and therefore their initial mass was smaller, and therefore the emitted energy was higher. And you end up with this yellow curve. So basically, there is no or nearly no redshift dependence, because you compensate the redshift by the fact that you are not emitted at the same time. Okay, conclusion. I think that the LQC bounds lead to a very interesting phenomenology. There are still important conceptual issues, but that's why we are paid for. The background dynamics is, in my view, about to be well understood. Dealing with perturbations is still complicated, and some work is required, but I think it's on the way. Thank you.
Questions?
You had all the questions. So thank you, Ivan, for having spoken before me. That's
good. So who has to consent? It's a consensual way. So who are the parties who have to consent to the consensual way? It's a perturbation.
Yeah.
The consensual way is hard.
Yeah. So your question is, why is it?
Who are the consenting parties, I guess? Consensual. I don't know. I guess I'm asking what you mean by consensual.
No, I think you have seen, right? There are a lot of discussions. I just mean here that, I mean, it's really a subtle question, because the problem at this time is that we don't have, I think, a completely satisfactory explanation, and different people focus on different problems. So each group finds a great solution to its own problem and seems that he has a final word. But of course, I mean, the other group says, yeah, but you don't answer my own problem. So we don't yet have a fully satisfactory explanation, but that's normal. I mean,
the same thing, slightly different words. I think I hope it is the same thing. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, the statement is that the question that came up was if you had this quantum geometry before the inflation phase, then how do you propagate? What do you think about the perturbations? How do you propagate? To where extent the notion of cosmological perturbations and their propagation in this regime, starting from the relativity era? And I would say not so much that everybody thinks that right or something, but it's more that of necessity, the way that we do always do research is to have a prejudice, or, you know, is well formed for our own reason, to say that this is what I should focus on. And so there are various ideas. One idea that was mentioned, that I guess you mentioned two ideas. There are two main broad class of ideas. One idea is really to say that, well, what we should do is to develop a perturbation theory for quantum fields, propagating quantum geometry. And now the question is, there are very multiple details here. How do you do that? It's a broad idea. But the other idea would be that, well, no, I mean, we should first look at how to embed this theory in a bigger theory, and then start from there and develop a perturbation theory. Of course, embedding in a bigger theory is a much challenging problem. And so here, the statement is that there is much more freedom. But again, there are several approaches that people are following. And so the question is, well, no, is that happening?
But I was a bit puzzled by the point raised by Neil at the previous talk, because I think it's not related directly to LQC. I mean, is he saying that gauge invariant variables in standard cosmology are not gauge invariant?
Yeah, he says that they're gauge fixed. I mean, so he's saying that they're like I think we have to discuss.
So,
I actually a couple of some points about that. I wanted to talk for a couple of minutes about that because that's something I've thought about. Maybe you can take the microphone.
Are there other questions to me?
Neil is not here, so it would be very good if he's present.
Let's first finish the questions to Onya, and then maybe give the stage to Niyaj. If there are any more questions.
I do. So, I mean, it's very natural that you focused on Shia, right? But of course, that's only one variable, right? I mean, so you're just looking at it because Bianchi models have shear, and so that is kind of the next variable to look at about probability distribution and so on, for the initial conditions, is that?
I'm not even sure it is the next variable, it is only the first variable, right? Because it's 1 over s to the 6. So if you have your Friedmann equation, of course, as you know, matter 1 over s to the cube, and radiation s to the 4th, and curvature 1 s squared, and shear 1 over s to the 6. So you wonder, what is the dominant term when a is very small? The natural answer is shear. So
no, but if I had inhomogeneities, then maybe this is all in the context.
But we have the same problem with inhomogeneities. But the problem is that if we begin to think about inhomogeneities, then it means that we don't have any more Friedmann equation. So it could be what happens, but then I cannot make any calculation.
So we're just looking at the anisotropic case, and then the dominating term is this, and therefore
Okay.
Omega that you have, presumably today is very close to 1.
Yes.
But not exactly 1. So could one think of any precision test that could astronomically
Yes, I think Jakub Milcharek has worked this out because it is indeed related with the deformation also of the Poincaré algebra, because to some extent this is the same problem, but either you deform with density or you deform with speed, and you can show that both are not actually independent. The problem is that, as usual, this is suppressed by terms as that are scaling as 1 over something which is of the order of the Planck scale squared. So that's very hard. I mean, this is all the phenomenology that you know very well that has been done by Yamelino Camellia and collaborators. So now there are maybe new results, but up to now it has not been very successful.
I mean, then this issue of covariance that came up several times comes to full vengeance, right, with this omega term in some ways, right? Because one has deformed this algebra.
Yes.
So that.
What we tried to do is precisely to be completely consistent. That is, that what I call, maybe Nell would not agree, but what I call my gauge invariant variable is defined according to this precise algebra. So I don't know if that's correct, but that's consistent.
But space-time geometry.
Yes.
Do we have a space-time geometry?
It's not Riemannian, for sure.
Yeah, it's not Riemannian.
If omega does not change sign, there's a Lie algebraic morphism which maps it to standard space-time structure,
yes,
which means the future redefinition of the metric.
But it does change sign.
And for that, for the new metric, you have the standard space-time structure.
Is that the physical metric, another one that you calculate in this room, which is the metric?
Well, I don't know. The metric is not physical. You don't measure the metric.
I do measure distances, so there's a. It's coupled with matter.
You can compute these observables, but then you don't need to know which metric you use. You have observables, and.
If you don't know the metric, then what is the perturbation equation satisfying?
The metric, once you make a choice, you can use. And once you've transformed to that new metric, you can use standard Riemannian geometry to compute.
So the perturbations contribute to, are really doing to this new metric.
You can binomize this. I mean, it's your choice. There are different formulations. As long as omega does not change sign, you get something that's completely non-classical. If it does change sign, then there's no Lie algebraic morphism.
One of them will correspond to the universe I observed today, and the other will not, right? I mean, just because two different metrics, so.
No, each of them is modified if omega is not equal to 1.
Okay,
exactly.
So say in Fisher epoch, one of them will, and the other will not. So.
Well, none of them would if you have these additional corrections, because you have a modified background.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Aurelien again.